listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Hello, KBOO supporters. It's tax season. To request a copy of your 2025 tax receipt, email membership@kboo.org or call at 971-801-1381. That's 971-801-1381 for your 2025 tax receipt. Thank you.
Check out Ear to the Streets of Portland with hosts Sequoina
and Kayla
every first and third Thursday of the month starting at 7 o'clock p.m.
Listen in as we interview community organizers, speak on issues focused on Black Portland, and share community events happening in the area and elsewhere.
Listen on the radio at 90.7 FM, online at www.kboo.fm, or from your mobile phone at m.kboo.fm.
Follow KBOO on Instagram at KBOO Radio. Ear to the Streets.
Usually around midnight, or you try to do some serious writing.
Was I bothering you when I turned that corner? Asked the woman. No, but you put yourself in contact with me, said the woman. If you think that contact is not going to last a while, you got another thought coming. When I get through with you, sir, you are going to remember Mrs. Luella Bates Washington Jones. I have done things, too, which I would not tell you, son. Neither tell God if he didn't already know.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Brian DeShazer. Uganda drops its first Kill the Gays case after destroying the defendant. New research debunks an advantage for trans female athletes. And Langston Hughes reads a story of Black family values. Those stories and more this week, because you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Michael Taylor Gray.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending February 7th, 2026. The first case against a gay man for violating Uganda's so-called Kill the Gays law is dismissed, but the damage has already been done. The defendant's lawyer proved to the court that his client's lengthy detention has caused serious mental illnesses, including schizophrenia. He has spent close to a year in prison as his case moved through the East African nation's legal system. Attorney Douglas Mawadri told Agence France-Presse that the judge found his client to be too mentally unstable to understand the trial process. The unnamed defendant is now 25 years old. The plight of his 41-year-old partner has not been reported. The younger man was accused of unlawful sexual intercourse in 2023, just 3 months after Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni signed the infamous and overwhelmingly popular Anti-Homosexuality Act. The law includes the death penalty for what it calls aggravated homosexuality, including repeated homosexual acts and sex that transmits HIV/AIDS or other potentially terminal illnesses. Same-gender intercourse with a minor, an elderly person, or a person with disabilities also fall into that category. Prosecutors never explained why they had lodged the original aggravated charges in this case. In January of 2024, they were lowered to unnatural offenses of having carnal knowledge against the order of nature, which is punishable by up to life in prison. The judge made sure in his February 3rd ruling that the now mentally incapacitated defendant would not face any charges. Queer advocates like Richard Lesimbo are outraged that the dismissal took almost 2 years. He told Agence France-Presse, "Detaining someone for over a year without trial is injustice at its worst."
Transgender female athletes have no physical advantage over their cisgender counterparts if they've received 1 to 3 years of gender-affirming hormone therapy. This according to new research published this week in the British Journal of Sports Medicine. 52 different studies conducted at academic and medical institutions in Brazil were considered. More than 2,900 trans women and about 2,300 trans men were involved, along with more than 560 cis women and more than 660 cis men. Most of the studies focused exclusively on adult athletes, but 7 included teens. The author's conclusion is that existing evidence does not support theories of inherent athletic advantages for transgender women over cisgenders. The academics lamented the relative dearth of top-level studies on trans athletes and called for further research. What they know now is that the current data does not justify blanket bans on trans athletes. University of Sao Paulo physician and co-author Bruno Guailano told Spanish-language newspaper El País, "Most of these policies are based on the assumption that transgender women retain inherent physical advantages and would therefore dominate women's competitions. The data does not support this idea."
Fewer transgender people were murdered around the world between October 2024 and September 2025. That's the good news. The bad news is that there were still 281 trans or gender diverse homicide victims during that time period, according to the global group Trans Murder Monitoring. Brazil is the worst place on the planet for trans people to live. It's topped the list ever since worldwide monitoring began in 2008. 77 murder victims in 2024-2025 were trans women or female presenting. 3 were trans men. 88% were black or of mixed race. 14% engaged in some form of activism. Those figures were released this week by Brazil's National Association of Transvestites and Transgender People. The group warns, the message could not be clearer. Lethal violence is now compounded by direct persecution of those who organize, mobilize, and expose injustice. The 80 Brazilian victims in 2024-2025 are still an improvement over the two previous years. In 2024, there were 122 murder of trans people reported by the Monitoring Project, and 145 in 2023. A significant number each year were sex workers. The South American country's civil society has tried to stem the tide. Supreme Court rulings have included marriage equality, adoption rights, and the ability of trans people to change their legal name and gender without having to undergo gender-affirming surgery. Homophobia and transphobia are criminal offenses in Brazil as a form of racism. Queer advocates hope those advances have been deterrents.
A Christian teacher is fighting a losing battle against the Montgomery County, Maryland Public School District's policy on using the chosen names and pronouns of her trans and non-binary students. Kimberly Polk is a substitute teacher in the district, and she claimed that being forced to follow the policy violated her constitutional, religious, and First Amendment rights. A 3-judge panel of the Richmond, Virginia-based 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals voted 2-1 on January 28th to support the school district upholding lower court rulings. Judge Robert B. King wrote for the majority, "How a teacher addresses a particular student in a particular classroom and whether a teacher communicates with the student's parents is merely a part of that teacher's job description." Polk's attorney, Rick Claybrook, told the Washington Post that he and his client are considering an appeal to the full Fourth Circuit or to the U.S. Supreme Court.
A record number of proud LGBTQ athletes are competing in the 2026 Winter Olympics in Milan and Cortina, Italy. The queer website Outsports.com counts 44, including Amber Glenn, the first publicly out queer women's figure skater in Winter Olympic history. She's a top U.S. hope for a figure skating medal. Ellis Lundholm of Sweden is the first out transgender competitor in the Winter Games. He'll be flying freestyle downhill on uneven terrain as a moguls skier. Team LGBTQ includes 34 women and 10 men. The 22 out female hockey players make it the runaway queerest Winter Olympic sport. 6 LGBTQ men and 1 woman will be figure skating. Alpine and freestyle skiing boasts 6 queer competitors each. Speed skating has 4, skeleton has 2, and there's 1 each from snowboarding, curling, and biathlon. Outsports.com's initial review finds queer Winter Olympians from at least 13 countries, the UK, the US, Canada, Finland, Sweden, Austria, Belgium, Brazil, France, Germany, Italy, Switzerland, and the Czech Republic. Outsports.com uses a pretty basic methodology. They review social media profiles for dozens of athletes looking for telltale clues about their being LGBTQ, and then contact the leading prospects to verify. You can check Outsports.com for more details about a wide range of competitors and updated stats. The Olympic opening ceremonies were held on February 6th.
Finally, thousands hit the streets of Melbourne on February 1st for the 31st annual Midsummer Pride March. The event's CEO, Karen Bryant, said in a message before the march began, "Though global rifts threaten us, we celebrate with pride in a way that is meaningful for us all." In the words of Victoria's State Commissioner for LGBTQIA+ Communities, Joe Ball, "Firefighters, scouts, nurses, teachers, councils, corporates, health services and schools, every part of our private, public, and civil society on motorbikes, using walkers, wheelchairs, and prams. We have Christians, Jews, Hindus, Muslims, and many people of all different faiths. Every major political party is represented, standing together, united. All of us gathering under shared values of equality, dignity, freedom, and safety. And this is how we do it in Victoria." Victorian Premier Jacinta Allen was also there with the biggest Midsummer Pride crowd in years. Her social media message read in part, "Pride is about being able to live your life openly without fear or apology. To anyone who's ever been made to feel different just because of who you are, you will always belong in our Victoria."
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending February 7th, 2026. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappelle, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Michael Taylor Gray. Stay healthy.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry. Stay safe.
You're listening to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. Now it's time to rewind the rainbow. This is The Rainbow Rewind,
where we take a quick look back at the people and the moments that made queer history.
I'm Brian DeShazer.
And I'm Sherry Lund.
This week we honor the February birthday of Alice Walker.
"Dear Nettie, I don't write to God no more. I write to you." "What happened to God?" asked Shug. "Who that?" I say. She look at me serious. "Big a devil as you is," I say, "you not worried about no God, surely." She said, "Wait a minute. Hold on just a minute here. Just cause I don't harass it like some people does, no, don't mean I ain't got religion." "What God do for me?" I asked. She says, "Silly," like she's shocked. "He gave you life, good health, and a good woman that love you to death.
Alice Walker is an important LGBTQ figure as an openly bisexual author and activist who normalized queer Black love in literature, most notably through the central relationship in her Pulitzer Prize-winning 1982 novel, The Color Purple. She challenged societal norms by depicting lesbian relationships as beautiful, natural, and liberating.
Now let's rewind to a few February key queer milestones. In 2020, Virginia became the first state in the American South to offer legal protections in employment, housing, and public accommodations to LGBTQ people. In 2011, civil unions, a separate and unequal version of gay marriage, are legalized in Hawaii.
A reminder that our history is built on courage, creativity, and community.
That's this week's Rainbow Rewind, because remembering our past fuels our pride. I'm Brian DeShazer.
And I'm Sherry Lunn. Stay tuned. More This Way Out is coming up.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
That's a classic by openly closeted composer Billy Strayhorn, who put the swing into the notorious heterosexual Duke Ellington's jazz that lit the Harlem Renaissance of Langston Hughes. Historian Henry Louis Gates Jr. says that the 1920s and 30s era in New York's African-American community was surely as gay as it was Black. Hughes apparently eluded the romantic advances of his gay literary peers Elaine Locke and County Cullen, and scholars now speculate that the one-time best friend of possibly bi Zora Neale Hurston was asexual. In 1963, the iconic author was the guest of a young reporter named Eve Corey at the studios of WBAI in New York City. We'll hear an excerpt of their conversation, followed by Hughes reading his short story, Thank You, Ma'am.
We kind of got you up this morning or this afternoon. It's 4 o'clock, and you say that you first get up at 4.
Well, I work at night, you see, and so sometimes I don't start writing until 12 or 1 o'clock because there's not much use trying to do anything that requires a great deal of concentration in New York in the daytime or in the early evening. One has usually many interruptions during the day. The phone rings 40 times. Strangers come by, relatives you haven't seen in 10 years.
They just drop in.
Drop in time. And you can't say no. So the result is that when peace and quiet settles down, it's usually around midnight, you see. Then I may try to, or usually do try to do some serious writing.
Hmm. Sort of the quiet time for you. And
yeah.
Then you spend the rest of the day doing what?
I read the mail, and the mail is... Oh, maybe sometimes a 2 or 3 hour task if one answers some of the letters immediately.
Mm.
Now that I'm writing for the New York Post, I get quite a deal of fan mail. And
what kind of letters do you get?
On the whole, very cordial and usually nice letters commenting on some aspect with which the writer agrees. But...
I knew there was going to be a but.
There's always a few letters of disagreement and sometimes violent disagreement. And once in a while from people who... are not very pro-civil rights. One gets angry and unsigned letters, Ku Klux Klan type of letters.
Really?
Yes.
Are these postmarked New York or?
Most of them are. Most of them seem to be Brooklyn.
You live in Harlem yourself.
I live in Harlem, which I like very much.
Mm.
So Harlem is no longer a place where you have to live if you don't want to, if you're colored. But I happen to like it very much. It's a very lively community, and so I live there. But many of my friends live in Park West Village in the 80s or down in the village or in Brooklyn or in the Bronx, you see. And there is, of course, housing difficulties still for colored peoples, but not anywhere near what they used to be.
Mm-hmm. You originally came from Joplin, Missouri. Did you move directly to Harlem?
Oh, no. I was just born in Joplin.
I see.
I don't even remember it. I've lived so many places since then.
Well, and you're a native New Yorker, almost.
Well, I've been here more or less off and on for at least 25 years.
You worked as a seaman, and you went to West Africa and Europe. Which sounds quite fascinating, especially the West Africa part.
Yeah, I had a wonderful series of trips and enjoyed them very much. And sometimes I wish I were a seaman again. You get to travel. On freight boats, I've never worked on passenger ships, but on freight boats they go rather leisurely, you know, and they stay in odd ports to which one would not otherwise be likely to visit. Can I read it now?
Yes, sure. Go right ahead.
All right. It's called Thank You, Ma'am. She was a large woman with a large purse that had everything in it but a hammer and nails. It had a long strap, and she carried it slung across her shoulder. It was about 11 o'clock at night, dark, and she was walking alone when a boy ran up behind her and tried to snatch her purse. The strap broke with a single sudden tug that the boy gave it from behind, but the boy's weight and the weight of the purse combined caused him to lose his balance. Instead of taking off full blast as he had hoped, the boy fell on his back on the sidewalk and his legs flew up. The large woman simply turned around and kicked him right square in his blue-jeaned sitter. Then she reached down, picked the boy up by his shirt front, and shook him until his teeth rattled. After that, the woman said, "Pick up my pocketbook, boy, and give it here." She held him tightly, but she bent down enough to permit him to stoop and pick up her purse. Then she said, "Now ain't you ashamed of yourself?" Firmly gripped by his shirt front, the boy said, "Yes'm." The woman said, "What did you want to do it for?" The boy said, "I didn't aim to." She said, "You a lie." By that time, two or three people passed, stopped, turned around on the street to look, and some stood watching. "If I turn you loose, will you run?" asked the woman. "Yes'm," said the boy. "Then I won't turn you loose," said the woman. She did not release him. "Lady, I'm sorry," whispered the boy. "Your face is dirty. I got a great mind to wash your face. Ain't you got nobody home, boy, to tell you to wash your face?" "No'm," said the boy. "Then it will get washed this evening," said the large woman, starting up the street, dragging the frightened boy behind her. He looked as if he were 14 or 15, frail and willow wild, in tennis shoes and blue jeans. The woman said, "You ought to be my son. I would teach you right from wrong. Least I can do right now is to wash your face. Are you hungry?" "No'm," said the being dragged boy. "I just want you to turn me loose." "Was I bothering you when I turned that corner?" asked the woman. "No'm." "But you put yourself in contact with me," said the woman. "If you think that that contact is not going to last a while, you got another thought coming. When I get through with you, sir, you are going to remember Mrs. Luella Bates Washington Jones." Sweat popped out on the boy's face, and he began to struggle. Mrs. Jones stopped, jerked him around in front of her, put a half Nelson around his neck, and continued to drag him up the street. When she got to her door, she dragged the boy inside, down a hall, and into a large kitchenette-furnished room at the rear of the house. She switched on the light and left the door open. The boy could hear other roomers laughing and talking in the large house. Some of their doors were open, too, so he knew that he and the woman were not alone. The woman still had him by the neck in the middle of her room. She said, "What's your name?" "Roger," answered the boy. "Then, Roger, you go to that sink and wash your face," said the woman, whereupon she turned him loose at last. Roger looked at the door, looked at the woman, looked at the door, and went to the sink. "Let the water run until it gets warm," she said. "Here's a clean towel." "You gonna take me to jail?" asked the boy, bending over the sink. "Not with that face. I would not take you nowhere," said the woman.
Here I am trying to get home to cook me a bite to eat, and you snatch my pocketbook. Maybe you ain't been to your supper either, late as it is. Have you? There's nobody home in my house, said the boy. Then we'll eat, said the woman. I believe you're hungry, or been hungry, to try to snatch my pocketbook. I want a pair of blue suede shoes, said the boy. Well, you didn't have to snatch my pocketbook to get some blue suede shoes, said Mrs. Luella Bates Washington Jones. You could have asked me. Ma'am? The water dripping from his face, the boy looked at her. There was a long pause, a very long pause. After he had dried his face, and not knowing what else to do, dried it again, the boy turned around, wondering what next. The door was open. He could make a dash for it down the hall. He could run, 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 run. The woman was sitting on the daybed. After a while, she said, I were young once, and I wanted things I could not get. There was another long pause. The boy's mouth opened. Then he frowned, not knowing he frowned. The woman said, uh-huh. You thought I was going to say but, didn't you? You thought I was going to say, but I didn't snatch people's pocketbooks. Well, I wasn't going to say that. Pause. Silence. I have done things, too, which I would not tell you, son. Neither tell God if he didn't already know. Everybody's got something in common. So you sit on a while I go and fix us something to eat. You might run that comb through your hair so you'll look presentable. In another corner of the room, behind a screen, was a gas plate and an ice box. Mrs. Jones got up and went behind the screen. The woman did not watch the boy to see if he was going to run now, nor did she watch her purse, which he left behind her on the daybed. But the boy took care to sit on the far side of the room, away from the purse, where he thought she could easily see him out of the corner of her eye if she wanted to. He did not trust the woman not to trust him, and he did not want to be mistrusted now. "Do you need somebody to go to the store?" asked the boy. "Maybe to get some milk or something?" "I don't believe I do," said the woman, "unless you just want sweet milk yourself. I was going to make cocoa out of this canned milk I got here." "That will be fine," said the boy. She heated some lima beans and ham she had in the icebox, made the cocoa, and set the table. The woman did not ask the boy anything about where he lived, or his folks, or anything else that would embarrass him. Instead, as they ate, she told him about her job in a hotel beauty shop that stayed open late at night, what the work was like, and how all kinds of women came in and out, blondes, redheads, and Spanish. Then she cut him a half of her 10-cent cake. "Eat some more, son," she said. When they were finished eating, she got up and said, "Now here, take this $10 and buy yourself some blue suede shoes. And next time, do not make the mistake of latching onto my pocketbook nor nobody else's, because shoes got by devilish ways will burn your feet. I got to get my rest now, but from here on in, son, I hope you will behave yourself." She led him down the hall to the front door and opened it. "Good night. Behave yourself, boy," she said, looking out into the street as he went down the steps. The boy wanted to say something other than, "Thank you, ma'am," to Mrs. Luella Bates Washington Jones. But although his lips moved, he couldn't even say that as he turned at the foot of the barren stoop and looked up at the large woman in the doorway. Then she shut the door.
You've been listening to Langston Hughes reading his 1958 story, Thank You, Ma'am.
Kelly Strayhorn.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. News Wrap was reported this week by Michael Taylor Gray and Tanya Kane Perry, and produced by Brian DeShazer. The Rainbow Rewind was written by Sherry Lund and produced by and co-hosted with Brian DeShazer. Thanks to the Pacifica Radio Archives for the Langston Hughes feature, which was edited by Greg Gordon. Chicago, and Duke Ellington and his orchestra featuring Billy Strayhorn performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks David Hunt of Raleigh, North Carolina, Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley celebrating their 50th year together, and all the listener donors who make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon, associate producer Lucia Chappell, and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Brian DeShazer. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts, and on Lofty FM, Adelaide Hills, South Australia, KGay, Thousand Palms, Coachella Valley, California, WCRS, Columbus, Ohio, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned.
Hi, this is Peter Himmelman. You're listening to KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM.
Is autism an epidemic? Or is it a superpower? Are you a little bit on the spectrum? Or are you hashtag actually autistic? I'm Carrie Stewart Lingle, host of NeuroEmergent. Join me from 11 a.m. to noon on the fourth Wednesday of every month to explore neurodiversity in the Pacific Northwest and beyond, right here on KBOO Community Radio.
Please welcome to the stage Don Lemon.
The First Amendment is not just a legal guarantee. We have to keep fighting for the First Amendment and fighting for all of our rights. It is the breath in the lungs of democracy. I'm not an activist. I'm not a protester. I am a journalist. And my calling is not to shout, but my calling is to witness. And that's what they're afraid of.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Same-gender couples get property rights in the Philippines, UK trans people can use toilets anywhere except work, and trumped-up charges plague gay journalist Don Lemon. Those stories and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Joe Bainline.
And I'm Sarah Montague.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending February 14th, 2026. Cohabitating same-gender couples in the Philippines can now be recognized as joint owners of property that they acquired during their relationship. The February 5th ruling by the Supreme Court has seemingly moved the Southeast Asian Islands nation one step closer to marriage equality. Two women had purchased a house and lot together during their relationship. The property in the Manila suburb Quezon City was only registered under one partner's name. When they split up, the unregistered partner wanted to partition the property or sell it. She produced a document signed by her ex confirming that she had paid about half of the purchase price for the property and its reservation costs. The registered partner first agreed, then rejected the document and broke the deal. So the unregistered partner filed a complaint. The Philippines Family Code defines civil marriage as a special contract of permanent union between a man and a woman. Because they are denied civil marriage in the predominantly Roman Catholic country, the court concluded that property questions involving same-gender couples are governed by Article 148 of the Code, which covers unmarried cohabitation. That provision makes the properties acquired by both of the parties through their actual joint contribution of money, property, or industry owned by them in common in portion to their respective contributions. The Supreme Court reversed lower courts that had rejected the unregistered partner's claim. It found that the signed acknowledgement was sufficient proof of her actual contributions to the property under Article 148, and that she is therefore entitled to demand its partition. The High Court issued a press release soon after the ruling was announced, calling on the government to address same-sex couples' rights as courts alone cannot resolve all related policy concerns.
Trans people in the United Kingdom can use bathrooms and changing rooms that match their gender identity, except in the workplace. That's the result of a February 13th Supreme Court ruling that grows out of last year's somewhat convoluted decision that trans women are not legally women under the Equality Act, but are nevertheless protected from discrimination. Now, the Trans Solidarity Alliance says the situation for trans people, employers, and service providers is completely incoherent. In this week's ruling, the justices decided that employers must provide separate bathrooms based on the worker's gender assigned at birth. That specifically denies trans employees access to bathrooms that match their gender identity. However, trans customers of the same establishments may be allowed to use gender-appropriate bathrooms. One justice told The Independent that service providers ranging from restaurants and bars to hospitals and government facilities should be guided by common sense and benevolence that is not blinkered by unyielding ideologies. The justices added in their ruling that employers are allowed to provide gender-neutral bathrooms for use by all staff, including trans employees. Without such accommodations, the organization Trans Solidarity points out that trans workers would not be able to do their jobs. They underscore the perplexity, saying, "What bathroom a trans person can use in a pub may now depend on whether they are there as an employee or for a drink."
Public school officials in the UK are being directed to notify parents if their child's behavior suggests that they are questioning their gender identity. Legally binding guidance issued on February 12th by the Department of Education also instructs school staff to discourage students from socially transitioning and to exercise extreme caution using a trans student's chosen name or pronouns. Under the guidance, trans students must not be allowed to use campus bathrooms or changing rooms that match their gender identity. This is about pragmatic support for teachers, reassurance for parents, and above all, the safety and well-being of children and young people, according to Education Secretary Bridget Phillipson. The guidance stands firmly on last year's much-criticized CAS review. That's a study that condemns the availability of puberty blockers and hormone therapies for trans young people. It led the government to ban their use in most cases. Cal Horton believes that the new guidance will do more harm than good for trans young people. Horton is a research fellow at the Oxford Brookes Business School, specializing in trans issues. Their analysis echoes that of several other critics. In Horton's words, "Trans children need to be supported and respected in order to be safe at school, in order to access their right to education, in order to enjoy their childhood. Instead, we are seeing a complete ban on access to appropriate toilets, PE, accommodation on school trips, a complete erosion of their rights." Horton concludes, "It will lead to children avoiding the bathroom, avoiding exercise, missing out on school trips, dropping out of school, and losing any hope of education, equality, friendship, or happiness."
It's the third strike for New Hampshire's trans student bathroom ban. Republican Governor Kelly Ayotte has for the second time vetoed a bill to require trans students to use sex-segregated school bathrooms and changing facilities that match their gender assigned at birth. Republican Governor Chris Sununu vetoed a similar bill the year before. In her 2025 veto message, Ayotte complained that the measure was overly broad and impractical to enforce, potentially creating an exclusionary environment for some of our citizens. The Republican-controlled legislature failed to secure a two-thirds majority vote needed to override Ayotte's veto last December. Observers believe an override will fail again. Amy Terevecchia of the statewide LGBTQ group 603 Equality applauded Governor Ayotte's veto, proclaiming, "Bathroom bans simply have no place in New Hampshire." In Terevecchia's words, "In a time of unrelenting legislative attacks and misinformation campaigns around transgender people and their rights, transgender and gender nonconforming people deserve safe access to public spaces as they go about living, working, and contributing to our communities."
Finally, embattled U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi's fiery five-hour joust with minority Democrats culminated in an explosive confrontation with Vermont's lesbian Congressmember Becca Ballant. The February 11th hearing before the House Judiciary Committee focused on the Justice Department's failure to release all of the files related to the late convicted child sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein. Both congressional chambers overwhelmingly approved opening the files, and the law was signed by Bondi's boss, President Donald Trump. Bondi reprised her belligerent performance before a Senate committee late last year, evading relevant questions while rifling through a binder of misleading information to use against Democratic committee members. Near the end of the hearing, Bondi attempted to deflect Ballant's examination by referring to a 2024 House resolution condemning the phrase, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free." Ballant joined more than 40 other Democrats voting against it and called the measure yet another way to sow division and demonize Palestinians, according to the Jewish News Syndicate. When Ballant asked if the Justice Department had seriously investigated powerful officials whose names appear in the Epstein files, Bondi's evasion enraged Ballant.
I want the record to reflect that, you know, with this anti-Semitic culture right now, she voted against a resolution condemning.
Oh,
is Jewish.
Oh,
I just want to be clear.
Oh, do you want to go there, Attorney General? Are
time
you serious
to the gentleman
talking
from
about
South
anti-Semitism
Carolina.
To a woman who Name. Lost her grandfather
I,
in the
I
Holocaust?
My time.
Really?
I my time.
Really?
As some of her Democratic committee colleagues came to her defense, Ballant stormed out of the chamber. She returned to sit with the Epstein survivors. Bondi just snickered.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending February 14th, 2026. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappell, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Sarah Montague. Stay healthy.
And I'm Joe Bainline. Stay safe.
You're listening to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. Now it's time to rewind the rainbow. This is the Rainbow Rewind,
where we take a quick look back at the people and the moments that made queer history.
I'm Sherry Lund.
And I'm Brian DeShazer.
This week, we honor the February birthday of Anais Nin.
As June walked towards me from the darkness of the garden into the light of the door, I saw for the first time the most beautiful woman on earth. A startlingly white face, burning dark eyes, a face so alive I felt it would consume itself before my eyes.
Anais Nin is considered an important figure in LGBTQ plus and feminist history, not necessarily because she identified strongly as a lesbian, but because she was a pioneer in advocating for sexual freedom, bisexuality, and women's sexual agency without shame.
Now let's rewind to a few February key queer milestones. In 1982, Wisconsin becomes the first state in the nation to make it unlawful for private businesses to discriminate based on sexual orientation in employment and housing. And in 2017, Moonlight becomes the first LGBT film to win the Academy Award for Best Picture.
A reminder that our history is built on courage, creativity, and community.
That's this week's Rainbow Rewind, because remembering our past fuels our pride. I'm Sherry Lund.
And I'm Brian DeShazer. Stay tuned. More This Way Out is coming up.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
The
U.S. Constitution's First Amendment free press rights clashed with its First Amendment freedom of religion when a gay African-American journalist was arrested. But was U.S. President Donald Trump's personal antipathy towards Don Lemon the real reason behind the charges? Federal judges have rejected the case concerning the former CNN host's coverage of a January 18th protest that breached a Minneapolis church whose pastor doubles as an immigration enforcement agent. Failing that, Attorney General Pam Bondi tweeted that she herself had directed the arrest. Lemon was in a Beverly Hills hotel on his way to cover the Grammy Awards when he was detained on January 29th by more than two dozen Homeland Security and FBI agents. He made a surprise appearance at the Human Rights Campaign's New York Gala on February 7th.
Hi, everyone. How are you? How was your week? Oh, let me tell you. All of those jailhouse scenes you see in certain movies, no, not that cute. Thank you guys for everything. Thank you for your support. Good evening. Good evening, family. How are you? Can I have a few minutes of your time? Because this is the only thing, I did Jimmy Kimmel and I'm doing this. Because this is really important. Because the freedom to live in America and be who you want, love who you want, it's a human right, right? The freedom of the press in this country is a human right. So for me, tonight feels less like a gala that you guys are here, and it feels more like a gathering, just sort of hanging out, a gathering of people who still believe that truth matters, right? Dignity is not optional. Freedom is not guaranteed. We've seen that in this time. This past week reminded me of something that I thought that I understood. The First Amendment is not just a legal guarantee. We have to keep fighting for the First Amendment and fighting for all of our rights. It is the breath in the lungs of democracy. It is the bedrock of our democracy. And when that breath is threatened, all of us can feel it before you can even explain it. Do you know that saying, I can't breathe? Our society cannot breathe without the freedom of the press, the freedom of speech. So last week, I felt it. I felt the smothering, the suffocation. I saw how quickly that a voice can be targeted, how easily truth can be distorted. Don't pay attention to the noise, people. Do not. I saw how fast a story can be turned into a warning. But I'm not an activist. I'm not a protester. I am a journalist. And my calling is not to shout, but my calling is to witness. And that's what they're afraid of that witness. To tell, you can applaud if you want. It is to tell. I feel so comfortable here, I could just, you know, hang out. It's to tell the truth as clearly as I can. And, but when, even when clarity, with clarity comes consequences. You guys know that, right? You saw what happened to me. There is a passage in the scripture that says, the truth shall set you free, or depending on which church or which Bible or which rendition of the Bible, King James or whatever, it'll say the truth shall make you free. But it doesn't say that the truth will make you safe. It does not say that it will make the powerful comfortable. That's not part of the promise. It does not say that it's going to spare you from the cost of seeing too clearly. And I think sometimes, not sometimes, many times, or most times, as members of the LGBTQ plus community, we see things a lot clearer than most people. And right now, that cost of the truth is rising, like the price of eggs and everything else in this country. We are watching an administration right now that treats the Constitution not as a covenant, but as an inconvenience that they don't have to abide by. This is inconvenient, and this is getting in our way. It's authoritarianism. And we need to be careful, because the very little that's left of our democracy can be gone in a second, if it's not too late already. We're watching leaders who speak of law and order while trampling on the very laws that restrain power, picking up people on the streets without due process. We are watching the Bill of Rights praised in speeches and ignored in practice. The First Amendment especially has become a target to this administration. Reporters are attacked as enemies, enemies of the people. How long have you been hearing that? 10 years now since Donald Trump has been in office. Facts are dismissed as disloyalty. Questions are treated as threats. And here's a truth that is harder to say. The most dangerous thing to any authority is not rebellion. I go back to that word. It is witness. It is they're afraid of the pen, the cameras, the witness. It's not outrage, but it's evidence. Witnessing is evidence. It's not noise, but truth spoken clearly. America loves the idea of a free press. We like to say, freedom press, freedom of speech, yeah, we're free. Like to recite it like a hymn, celebrates it as if it's a tradition, invokes it as if it is a slogan. But the press is only welcome when it does not disturb comfort. That's what power does. It doesn't want their comfort disturbed. When it does not expose the power would rather conceal. What power would rather conceal? That's when it is welcome. The free press does not exist to reassure the nation. It exists to reveal it to itself. The free press is a mirror to a society. It's where we test our ideas. It's where we test our democracy. We have seen what happens when that revelation is punished. We have seen journalists arrested while covering protests. We have seen reporters threatened for investigating corruption and violation. We have seen books removed from schools because they told inconvenient truths about race, gender, and sexuality. What is that? And we have seen journalists singled out, smeared, and targeted simply for doing their jobs. You guys know who James Baldwin is, right? My literary hero. He understood that clarity carries consequences. Of course you know who Dr. King is. He knew that truth invites punishment. And generations before us understood that when truth threatens power, power will respond. And it won't always be nice. Most of the times, it is not nice. I would say all of the time. So last week, I felt the weight of that truth in a very, very personal way. Can you imagine the state having control of your freedom simply because they don't like that you are doing your job? So that was very frightening to me, but in my time when I was there, I thought about all the people who'd come before me. I thought about all of the people who fought for civil rights, who fought for gay rights, all of the people who were at Stonewall, Marsha P. Clark. I'm like, yes, those are the people, those are the real heroes. And so what's happening to me, I have at least in this time that I'm living now, more agency, more resources, more rights, and I would hope, than the people who were fighting for our freedom and our civil rights. But I also felt something else. I felt the quiet courage of colleagues who refused to be intimidated. When I walked out, I was surprised by the statements that people had made, by the support that I had. I felt the solidarity of people who understood that this moment was bigger than one story, one journalist, one controversy. Because when a society punishes journalists, it is not punishing a profession. What it's punishing is reality. When reporters are silenced, citizens are blinded. When truth is criminalized, freedom becomes fragile. When the First Amendment becomes optional, democracy becomes hollow. There is an old spiritual that says, does anybody go to the black church here, anybody? Anybody? Anybody know that old spiritual that said, ain't gonna let nobody turn me around, turn me around, turn me around, ain't gonna let nobody turn me around, gonna keep on a walking, keep on a talking, marching on to freedom land. And that's what we're doing. That song was never loud. It was never loud for the sake of noise. It was steady, it was stubborn, it was unyielding. And that's what a free press must be in this time. Not, you don't have to be theatrical, you don't have to be reckless, but unwilling to be turned around, unwilling to give false equivalency, unwilling to give people a platform who simply want to lie and obfuscate and demean people who are not in power, especially people of color and people of LGBTQ folks. So I stand here tonight, not as a victim of a difficult week, but as a witness to a larger truth. Freedom is fragile, but it's not finished. I should add a word to that when I was writing this. Freedom is fragile, but it is not finished yet, because it can be. Truth is contested, but it is not defeated yet. Democracy is strained, but it is not silent yet, right? We got to keep fighting. A free press is not only holy because journalists are perfect, it is holy because it is one of the few places where power can still be questioned, where stories can still be told, where the voiceless can still be heard. And the LGBTQ plus community knows this very deeply and personally. Every right that exists today, it exists because someone refused to be silent. Because someone told the truth when silence would have been safer. Comfort is a poison. Everyone is so used to being comfortable right now. They're not used to sacrificing anything. We have grown so comfortable. We have everything right in the palms of our hands. We have a computer that we carry around every day that can get us all the information that we ever need. And you have your own network in your pocket. But we have become really comfortable. We got to be careful, because that comfort will be the end of our democracy and the end of our rights. All of those things, all of the rights that we have today, as I say, yet, because someone insisted on being seen. So tonight in this room, I see people who have chosen to insist. This is an organization that has chosen to insist. So I am not here to retreat. I am not going to retreat. I am not here to dramatize. I am here to testify in the way that journalists testify, by saying plainly that truth matters, witness matters, and silence has never been neutral. And as long as there are people willing to speak, as long as there are journalists willing to observe and tell a story, as long as there are communities willing to defend dignity, the light is still on. It has not gone out yet. And if the light is still on, the darkness has not won. So thank you for carrying that light, and thank you for your courage, and thank you for letting me bear witness with you tonight. Have a great evening, everybody.
A week after his human rights campaign speech, independent journalist Don Lemon appeared in court on February 13th, along with Minneapolis reporter Georgia Fort and others in the church protest case. All pleaded not guilty to two federal crimes: conspiring to violate someone's constitutional rights and violating the FACE Act, which ironically began as a law to protect women's health clinics. Lemon spoke to the press after the court proceedings.
People are finally realizing what this administration is all about. The process is the punishment with them. And like all of you here in Minnesota, the great people of Minnesota, I will not be intimidated. I will not back down. I will fight these baseless charges, and I will not be silenced.
Black gay journalist Don Lemon's attorneys say that they will fight the case on constitutional grounds. He has the support of the International Women's Media Foundation, the National Association of Black Journalists, and NLGJA, the Association of LGBTQ Plus Journalists. Thanks for finding This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. NewsWrap was reported this week by Joe Bainline and Sarah Montague, and produced by Brian DeShazer. The Rainbow Rewind was written by Sherry Lunn and produced by her co-host Brian DeShazer. Thanks to the Human Rights Campaign for sharing Don Lemon's speech at their New York City gala. Seals and Crofts and Sweet Honey and the Rock performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks Jim Kennedy of Dayton, Ohio, Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley celebrating their 50th year together, and all the listener donors who make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappelle. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And on KCMJ Colorado Springs, Colorado, WHYS Eau Claire, Wisconsin, CFRC Kingston, Ontario, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned, y'all.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
Be sure to tune into Radio Lost and Found, where many radio mysteries will be revealed. Radio Lost and Found is